Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Stay tuned for the second half of our interview with naturopathic physician John Furlong about ways that naturopathy can help prolong your life and keep your brain healthy. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we're listening to the second half of an interview with naturopathic physician John Furlong, who practices at the Center for Integrative Medicine and Pain Management in Hartford, Connecticut, which can be found at cim-pm.com. John, I want to shift course a little bit here and talk about ways in which naturopathy directly impacts on the principal concerns of my constituency, the transhumanist audience, and that is the improvement of mental function and life expectancy. Mm-hmm. A lot of my listeners would like to live a couple hundred more years, and they think that they have to live at least another 20 or 30 more years in order to be able to live a couple hundred more years. And so they are willing to take just about any handful of pills that you can actually show would benefit them in that regard. And in the meantime, anything that you think would make them smarter, have longer memories, stave off the degradation of the brain there towards the end.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an area of significant interest to me. There's a number of angles. One almost categorical statement that I will make is that just about everyone on the planet, or certainly that has access to it, would benefit from a potpourri of antioxidants. Antioxidants cover so many bases that involve the slow decrease in function and susceptibility to damage of tissues and organs that it just makes good sense. It's good preventive care to have and not just one antioxidant, not just beta carotene or whatever, but a mixture of them. Clearly, we have indications that one isolated antioxidant is probably not a good thing. They are biochemically intertwined and they have interactions that they must support each other, and so taking a combination seems to be the way to go. So antioxidants are pretty hard to beat. They're also found in foods. For example, the carotenoids as a family have many different functions, including antioxidant, and just about any vegetable or fruit that is brightly colored, yellow, green, orange, purple, red, white even with cauliflower, for example, is high in carotenoids and flavonoids, and these have beneficial influence. So that's sort of the dietary end of things. It doesn't necessarily have to be from a pill.
We talk about the need to have these things in combination, but there's been some pretty exciting research recently, for instance, with resveratrol, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. is the one of the principal ingredients in red wine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mice that get up and dance the Macarena after they've been on resveratrol for a while. There's some evidence, it seems like there's some evidence that with various antioxidants and with some of these other supplements, that it's virtually impossible, certainly with an ordinary American diet, and even with an aggressive life extension diet, to get the amount of these supplements into your system that would be clinically beneficial, according to some of the research. Or mm-hmm. do you not think that that's the case?
I think that, I mean, it's one of a number of issues. If, for example, the diet was optimal, the exercise was optimal, the stress factors and exposure to toxin factors were optimal, can do pretty well with dietary sources. If we're sort of living in the modern world, living a modern life, and wanting to have that above and beyond to help length and quality of life, then I agree. You kind of have to go up above the level that you could get from the typical diet or even a diet where you're trying hard. You really have to get to a therapeutic level. And resveratrol is very interesting stuff. One of the principles that I wanted to share, which you all are probably quite familiar with, is the idea of genetics or the genetic expression as a static process. And that is sort of an idea that most people have, that, well, you've got these genes and that's the luck of the draw. You know, you get good genes, great, you live to be 100. And if you don't have good genes, then, you know, too bad. There's some examples out there, and they're just really the tip of the iceberg, that essentially what it comes down to is the expression of the genes can be modified by the environment of an individual, whether that be the toxins they're exposed to or their diet or a combination thereof. So, for example, there's a type of hemoglobin made by the body called fetal hemoglobin. It has a higher capacity to bind oxygen. So during life in utero, the baby is actually able to get oxygen from the mother's blood supply. Very, you know, efficient, convenient. At birth, due to some changes from the partial pressure of oxygen and so on, and being out of the womb, the production of fetal hemoglobin drops off to almost nil. The genes to produce it are still there, but they're just not on. They're turned off. And with some recent work with cases of sickle cell disease have shown that there's certain chemical compounds that can actually turn back on the fetal hemoglobin to an extent. And therefore, these people have less likelihood of sickle cell crisis, sickle cell manifestations. So the genes are there, but they're constantly being turned off and on. Our exposures to chemicals will turn them off and on. It's estimated that more than half of the cancers in this country are really environmentally caused. Not that people are living in Love Canal or something, but that their exposure to certain chemicals in the compound and the susceptible genetics are such that it turns them over into a different functional state.
One of the big chemicals that's implicated in carcinogenesis are both organic hormones in our bodies, like a testosterone and estrogen, as well as their mimics in our environment. And just to shift, go back to our previous discussion about the clinical efficacy and kind of the boundaries of alternative medicine, one realm of life extension research has been hormone replacement mm-hmm. as people age, melatonin, estrogen replacement therapy, DHEA, which is yeah, DHEA, sure. Things like that. Where do you see that fitting in with the work that you do? And, I mean, certainly the debacle of estrogen replacement therapy being shown to be more harmful than good has not been very positive for that
right,
field.
Right.
But testosterone still out there as a possibility.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a lot of positive things to say about human growth hormone, mm-hmm, although mm-hmm. some people are saying some negative things as well. So.
Right. Yeah, it's a huge area of interest and practice. There's a handful of clinics all over the country and world that really have specialized in longevity medicine. There's a huge conference in Las Vegas every year that I've attended on a couple of occasions.
Association A4M. Anti-Aging Medicine.
Right, exactly. And there's some very sharp people there that are using this in clinical practice. And no doubt about it, if a 55-year-old is administered growth hormone, DHEA, maybe testosterone and whatever to a level that would approximate the levels found in a 25 or 30-year-old, they will feel very different. And their, quote, quality of life can really make a big difference, really make a big jump for the better. And that's something to look at. The challenge is, and we don't know this yet, is how long can that be sustained without problems? And that's where the issues come in with growth hormone is perhaps a greater risk of diabetes and other situations and stimulating tissues that really are sort of tired of being stimulated. This is what happens with
testicular cancer, breast cancer.
Exactly. And so we look at this, well, we know what the hormone does. We know that it has all these anabolic effects for bone mass, muscle mass, and vitality in general. And can the tissues support that? For 50 years instead of 35 at such a high level. And I don't personally think we know just yet. I think the material's coming out, the literature's coming out, the experience is starting to come out, but there's a downside to it that we don't quite know how to approach at this point.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of an going back to your previous recommendations, in terms of, say, an anti-cancer therapy, starting with the antioxidants, what antioxidants would you recommend? Obviously, eat as many vegetables and fruits as you can.
Right, right.
Would you recommend supplementation with quercetin or something like that?
Right. The flavonoids, one of which is quercetin, are quite ubiquitous in foods. They have huge range of activity. Quercetin is quite unique because it is fat-soluble. Most of the flavonoids are water-soluble. So quercetin has some profound effects on allergic response. And, you know, that's mostly what it's used for. But it's also very helpful at protecting the fatty compartment in the body. So that's certainly the flavonoid category, and quercetin being one of them, is a strong point. The other area that a fair amount of research with, and more gets back to the herbal medicine, is the use of adaptogens, as they're called. Historically and cross-culturally, the use of these adaptogenic herbs or life-extending herbs or sort of vitality-enhancing herbs go all over the world. And most of them have a couple of interesting attributes, one of which is most of them, in addition to certain compounds that are looked at as supporting adrenal function, for example, most of them also have what's called a saponin compound. Saponins are soap-like or chemical compounds that form soaps. So if you get a saponin compound and you mush it up in water and you jazz it around a little bit, it'll form bubbles and soaps. And that is, in some areas, is thought to be one of the mechanisms, as it can help to solubilize the cell membranes, keep the cell membranes clean, so to speak, so there's better communication between the hormones and the receptors and so on.
It's one of the theories of aging is that we get a kind of hardening of our cell membranes from sugars that accumulate there.
That's very true, and that's why certain conditions like diabetes, is the classic example, have some tissues having rapid aging, is the cell membranes become stuck together. They don't flow as well as they should. The cell membrane should be like the surface of a soap bubble. It should flow and move. And when that is impaired due to diet or oxidation or sugar causing these proteins to congeal, so to speak, it affects the cell function. And that only tends to reduce the efficacy of the cell.
So what are we talking about? Ginseng and things like that?
Ginseng is the standard one that people know. Siberian ginseng. There's some in South America. Suma is the sort of South American ginseng. And then in India, the ashwagandha is sort of that genre. And so all of these have the adaptogenic properties. A new one now, or not a new one, but where the new research is one from Siberia called rhodiola. And these all have been used in a fair amount of clinical research. A lot of the research on Siberian ginseng was done by the Russian Navy back in the 70s and 80s. And basically they find in human models that it improves the ability to do work under stress, do it accurately with better sort of sense of equilibrium. And in animal models, clearly it shows a protection of the adrenals. So the adrenals do not start to either hypertrophy or actually involute with chronic stress. And so we have both an animal model or a lot of animal models that show that it makes some sense, and in some human experiments as well.
Now, there's an enormous amount of controversy about exactly what the mechanisms are behind heart disease. And, the science seems to change every single week. And I'm actually on the Atkins diet right now, which is... I've been a vegetarian sympathizer for years, but the mounting clinical evidence in favor of Atkins as a weight loss technique, and I've lost 35 pounds with it, finally convinced me to try it. So, with Atkins, there's evidence that if you actually adhere to the diet, it actually lowers your cholesterol along with the weight loss. If people were, I'm not asking necessarily about your opinion of Atkins, though I'm certainly interested to hear it. What's your general advice for clients who would come to you for heart disease, a familial pattern of heart disease risk?
A couple things. If it's a familial pattern, there's clearly ethnic groups that are at much higher risk, and that has to be put into the picture.
African-Americans,
Hispanics, anyone with Native American blood are at significantly higher risk, and there's lots of theories for that evolutionarily, but suffice it to say that they're at higher risk. Those groups also tend to respond pretty well to a diet that limits the release of insulin, which is basically what Atkins does. They're more sensitive to insulin in the sense of when insulin is around in the body, their bodies are more efficient at storing calories as fat. And also, when insulin is up, due to some of the other processes that you mentioned earlier, advanced glycosylation products, there's a greater tendency to have oxidation damage. So by using that type of diet that minimizes insulin, the amount of wear and tear does decrease.
Reduces their diabetes in general.
Right. I mean, it will reduce, if they are diabetic, that type of diet will tend to markedly change the severity of their diabetes, in some cases even reverse it. And if they're pre-diabetic or with the metabolic syndrome, it will often over time really revert them to a normal state. And that can be seen biochemically through laboratory testing. That was one other area that I wanted to touch on is laboratory testing for not just high cholesterol, but for people at risk of metabolic syndrome or at risk for diabetes has gotten much more sophisticated. And there's some very inexpensive tests that give a much better window on true cardiovascular risk, such things as homocysteine, high sensitivity C-reactive protein. These are, quote, new risk factors that are in addition to and actually almost separate from the issue of cholesterol and lipids and so on. So by getting that complete picture from the laboratory, it's much more efficient to treat someone because you can not only address their lipids but other inflammatory processes. And that's really looking to be the inciting problem with in heart disease is a level of inflammation inside the blood vessels that starts an irritation, and that's where the plaques, the fatty plaques, start to form. The immune system has been stimulated, and once they're stimulated, the plaques are actually sort of a secondary or even tertiary response. And if we can address that inflammation, have the lipid profile be optimal, then there really is nothing to initiate the cardiovascular disease.
Do you recommend statins? Or, I mean, not that you can prescribe them, but...
Statins work pretty well. It's one of those things where if you look at the science, at least it's, as it's been gathered, it's pretty clear. They improve the quality of the fats in the body. They lower cholesterol. They reduce risk. Yes, there are some biochemical realities with statins that I think need to be a little bit better appreciated, in that they reduce an enzyme HMG-CoA reductase. It produces the cholesterol. That's how they act. In the process of doing that, they also decrease the production of a very important antioxidant compound, coenzyme Q. As you probably remember, a few months back, the folks that were having basically their muscles break down when they're on the statins, the one statin that came out and was henceforth recalled, that the mechanism proposed in that is that basically the muscles didn't have adequate levels of coenzyme Q. This statin was particularly damaging there, and that's why the muscles broke down. Well, that process is present even with a standard dose of some of the, two or three now statins that are out there. And many people that are on statins, doing well with their cholesterol, their lipid profiles improved, they will still complain of the side effect of muscle aches and soreness. And that's thought to be one of the things that we can do from a preventive, more biochemistry viewpoint, to mitigate the effects of the statins without creating a problem in its efficacy.
This is Dr. J. I'm a doctor of sociology, not a doctor of medicine, so this is all off the top of my head, but I've always had a passionate interest in it. I'm speaking today with John Furlong. John is a naturopathic physician. He works with the Center for Integrative Medicine and Pain Management in Hartford, Connecticut at cim-pm.com. John, take it in a slightly different direction. I have a child who has Tourette syndrome, and there's some evidence that marijuana is useful for the reduction of tics. I don't know if you've given much attention to the various efficacies, the potential clinical efficacies of marijuana for this wide variety of things that it's being looked at for. Unfortunately, not clinically tested for, because we don't do enough clinical testing of it. But in fact, no one in the United States is doing research on marijuana and Tourette's. It was all done in Germany. But do you talk to patients about marijuana, and what things would you recommend marijuana for?
Don't have a lot of experience with it as far as recommending it. There's certain downside to that. It certainly has some...
Are you worried about prosecution?
Not really. It's something that it's somewhat loaded politically, certainly. And most of the time, there are other options that aren't perhaps as complicated. Clearly, a lot of work has been done with its use in glaucoma. And that seems to be effective. I have had a number of patients say, it really does work, and my pressures go down, and my ophthalmologist is happy, and we're all fine just the way it is, and that's great. Doing some research, and I'm trying to remember the name of the plant. There are some other plants that have similar effects that aren't regulated per se,
or psychoactive,
So. It's not something that I've gotten into particularly, but it certainly seems to be effective. I used to work at a children's hospital out in Seattle, and they were using THC in some cases for pain and for helping with these kids who were having nausea. And that there seems to be a fair amount of efficacy there too. Again, dependent upon the individual. Again, as a naturopath, my tendency is to say, well, if THC works, and you're concerned about any side effects on immune system, for example, probably the whole plant would probably work just as well and not have as many side effects. But that's not happening.
Eat a brownie.
Right.
So Let's talk about neuroprotection a little bit. What regimes, what plants and substances, dietary habits, supplements, whatever, do you recommend for neuroprotection? People who are concerned about memory loss and mental acuity.
Yeah. It's been pretty well shown through a number of studies that basically the use it or lose it theory. You know, the more you use your mind, the more it stays active, the more you continue to form neurotransmitter links and new budding of the axons and dendrites, and that's going to improve function. So that, you know, that holds true. It also gets back to cardiovascular, that if the blood vessels are inflamed, if there is micro blockages in the blood vessels, no matter where they are, but especially so in the brain, it's going to impair function.
Mental and physical exercise.
Exercise for sure. It's requisite for any sort of longevity and quality of life, and to maximize that, it's got to happen. There are ways to improve it. For example, again, another very well-researched herb is ginkgo biloba. It's, you know, people think of it sort of next response is, oh, yeah, that memory herb. Well, yes, it can improve memory, mostly if deficiencies in memory are due to poor circulation. That's its main mechanism of action. It tends to improve what's called the microcirculation. Has some effects on decreasing platelet aggregation, so on. So it has a number of areas of influence. But improving circulation to the brain in particular, ginkgo does that. And the bulk of studies do support its activity as far as a short-term memory enhancer. Even in young people, doesn't have to be old people, but young people too. So improving the microcirculation through exercise, through minimizing cardiovascular wear and tear and inflammation, and yes, perhaps using something like ginkgo. Cayenne pepper is also a very good vasodilator, and used chronically can reduce some of the tendency for contraction of blood vessels. Other than that, the work on hormones and the brain and mental function is challenging. A couple of years ago, there were some articles that came out about estrogen, how important estrogen was to maintain, for lack of a better term, sort of plasticity and activity of the brain. And just recently, I was reading an article that sort of, you know, said that really wasn't true. So, you know, the word is out both ways, which means, well, we can throw up our hands and say we don't know yet. But certainly adequate levels of hormones, particularly early and through the mid part of life, probably makes a difference. The stimulation of the thought process, the motivation, for lack of a term, may be looked at also as a function not only of estrogen but also testosterone. And clearly both men and women have that required level or that optimal level of testosterone to kind of keep things jazzed up and moving. And that's undoubtedly a piece to it as well.
An engagement with life, basically.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I was watching Shawshank Redemption last night, and that was a quote that came up, either you know, get busy living or get busy dying. And that's what it comes down to. There's lots to do and lots of ways to optimize it. And the tendency or the potential of taking lots of things with forestalling death in mind is one way to look at it. But then if you sort of flip that around slightly and say, well, I want to do these things to enhance my life because there's so many things I want to do and explore and yet to accomplish, then it puts a very positive spin on it, which gets into the whole sort of mind-body connection, which is an important aspect as well.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think things are going with naturopathy in terms of the pharmaceuticalization of these substances? I mean, I can imagine both because of the enormous profit motive involved that a lot of things that will be clinically efficacious but can't be patented anymore will never be promoted and probably never be approved. And those things which are sold to us and promoted by allopathic medicine and perhaps eventually by naturopaths will be those substances that have been extracted and given to people in a pill so that you don't have to eat broccoli. You can just take it in a pill. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you think that's the direction that things are going, or is naturopathy going to win a lifestyle change for people? I don't see that happening.
That's a tough one. I mean, it's also tough because, you know, the lifestyle change that was put out to us as far as, you know, lower fat, lower your cholesterol. The amount of money and effort and sort of broadcasting that all over the country, it really did work. I mean, people lowered their fat intake, and whether or not they really did anything to help their cardiovascular disease is probably not the outcome. But things did happen when that much money and attention is thrown at it from a number of different areas, both politically and medically. It's tough. We look at the example of where naturopathy or natural medicine is in Europe, and Germany's probably a good example. They have a lot of research in natural medicines, and particularly plant medicines. They have a system of educating their practitioners such that a physician will get his MD or her MD and then go on and specialize in phytotherapy. And they have a whole bunch of pharmaceutical agents that are controlled by the industry there, not available over the counter in a grocery store or health food store, that are derived from natural products and used as medicines by those types of physicians. If we were to move to that, in some ways it could be beneficial. I think there'd be more scientific rigor with what's going on with the various agents. On the downside, there's a huge not undercurrent, there's a huge presence of people that are buying supplements at the health food store out of their own pocket for their own selves, and they don't want that governmental oversight or control. They want to be able to buy their supplements without having to go see a doctor to get it. And as we saw back, I think it was 92, with some attempts to modify the labeling by the FDA, there was just a huge public outcry about that, and I think it made a difference. And I don't know if that's that public desire to have their own supplements is going to allow the tight constraints to happen, other than those things that are shown to be dangerous per se, which will happen slowly, but perhaps inexorably.
One of the things that I've long supported, and actually it's the only thing that former Vice President Dan Quayle ever promoted that I supported, was the harmonization of American pharmaceutical regulation with European and Canadian pharmaceutical regulation. We now see that clearly with this debate over whether the same drug sold in Canada can be imported to the United States, and the absurd claims that it's so unsafe. There is a lot of research being done in Europe, especially in Eastern Europe, about the clinical efficacy of substances which have never been tested in the United States, and some naturopathic substances. Do you think if we had harmonization, a greater openness to the use of European clinical evidence, that there would be substances that we would be using here that we aren't currently?
I think so, for sure. We tend to be fairly limited in willingness to look at research from other countries in the U.S. It's sort of, if it's written here, great, and maybe some of the journals from the U.K., Lancet, for example, but if it's from, you know, Estonia, it's probably not going to get looked at very seriously, which is too bad, because there's some very good work going on there and has been for years. I think that the harmonization of the pharmaceutical industry per se, I mean, it gets into a whole sort of paranoia-inducing mode of, well, who's going to be pulling the strings? If, you know, the big names in pharmaceuticals are going to be pulling all the strings, then that's going to mean they've got to turn a profit on it. And that means a lot of things that could be good aren't going to happen. Or they may take a, like you were mentioning earlier, a natural product, modify it so it's a unique chemical, and then they can patent it and, you know, they're on their way. But it's different than the original formula, original plant.
Well, again, I've been speaking with John Furlong. He's a physician, naturopathic physician at the Center for Integrative Medicine and Pain Management in Hartford, Connecticut. You can find the center at cim-pm.com. And John, I really appreciate your coming on, and people can contact you through this website.
Yep, that would be fantastic. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the second half of an interview with naturopathic physician John Furlong, who practices at the Center for Integrative Medicine and Pain Management in Hartford, Connecticut, which you can find online at cim-pm.com. For the first half of the interview, you can find that at changesurfer.com. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.